Our ability is what makes us proud of ourselves. Ability is measured exclusively by achievement. So it is achievement that occasions pride. Each of us has a standard of achievement we impose upon ourselves. If we falter, stumble, or halt in meeting that standard, then we begin to lose our self-respect. If this failure, the dreaded fall, turns out to be the loss of the pride that occasioned continues, so too does the drainage of pride. No, let me read that. If this failure continues, so too does the drainage of pride. The dreaded fall turns out to be the loss of the pride that occasioned it. If we do not feel good about ourselves, we can no longer count on others feeling good about us. So we look for evidence that others hold us in low esteem. That's when the game begins. Or put it in another language, that's when the tactics start. It's when we hold ourselves in low esteem and are beginning to wonder if others do too. This course is about the fall. The fall from grace, from good fortune, from luck, favor, fame, good name, acclaim, success, position, power. All those, these losses comprising a measure of the human capacity to go to hell. Indeed, hell is a metaphor for illness of mind, the torment we meet and that is meted to us. To fall is to fail. To fail is to be ashamed. Shame makes us do insane things, and others respond in kind, and we are in hell. Now, we are proud, I'm saying, of our achievement, and our achievement is based on our abilities. And each of us develops a standard of achievement, our own internal thermometer. And if we fall short of that mark that we have set for ourselves, then comes shame. Note that achievement can be in a domain of our own abilities. We do not have to achieve in somebody else's domain. Note that our pride, we are proud of our intelligence. And if we begin to doubt our intelligence, for whatever reason, and there are a thousand ways that we could, that can be come into doubt, our own doubt, it is then that we begin to behave in a tactical way instead of an ordinary run-of-the-mill mutual productive exchange way. Now, a word about values, desires, preferences. The character theory says that people like to do what they're good at. They value those types of behavior that they can do effortlessly and with ease and without a great deal of ado. And they do not prefer, do not enjoy, don't get their jollies out of doing things that are hard for them to do, and put them to the task, so to speak. And notice that this in the character theory or type theory or temperament theory, the values differ radically. So that the interpreters value ethics, and I call them the ethical types. That's Greek for good, I guess. I'm not sure. I think that where I'm going to do a little work on that word, but it's for now, think of it as being interested in what is good for man. The other word that the interpreters get their jollies out of is morale. This is the moral ethical corner. The value system hinges around this, and the theory is that when one doesn't get to do some things that contribute to morality or ethics, the betterment of man in some spiritual way, then that person begins to feel like a failure. And if that goes too low, let's say if self-esteem goes too low, then the person has to engage in some kind of tactical maneuvers to stop the flow of value or the loss or the drainage of value. The analysts, the NTs, are thought to be interested primarily in logic. Science, powers, I should say, and in the degree, another word for it is competence, and in the degree that value is diminishing, that sense of doing that sort of thing well, then again we get this person feeling shame, and then that starts. And he starts doing something to protect himself from the drainage of his values. The adjudicators are interested in what is called enculturation, or short culture, to solidify and protect social institutions. And their abilities tend to be along those lines, and if that value is not met, that need is not met to be a part of this process of enculturation, then again, start feeling shame. The artists, I suppose, are primarily concerned with the being in on the act of presenting beauty and grace. Skill, doing things skillfully, and if that wanes, so if let's say if they lose their pride in whatever it is they're doing, then shame enters, and indeed shame is the reciprocal of pride. So what I'm saying is that you might call this the valuability theory. Abilities and values are correlated, and if one's ability to do these value things seems to be waning, that's when shame enters. So then tactics begin. When shame enters, it ushers in the tactical side. Or the way Alfred Adler used to put it, he would say that one turns to the useless side, which of course implies that one is working on the useful side, useful in these different ways, and when you can't be useful anymore, or you begin to feel ashamed of your utility to the general good, that's when you turn to the useless side. But I don't think that was quite as quite an adequate way of putting it. That's why I would say you turn to the tactical side, away from the productive side, when your productions are in arrears. That I think that idea is very important for healers. I think it's very important for healers to believe that. Whether it's true or not, think about it a minute. If you figure your patient, no matter what age, what sex, what race, what political persuasion, what religious persuasion, that his fundamental problem is shame and an attempt to get away from it, think what that will do to your therapeutic strategies. What do you have to do now? Well, first thing, you'll have to do what Rogers preached. Got to show him some respect. Why do you think almost all therapeutic stratagems work in this perspective? Just take this perspective for a moment. Why do you think they work? They're so radically different from each other, and yet most of them seem to work just rather nicely. Why? Because built into every one of them is an automatic show of respect. And here's an important, successful person showing respect to a person that's down and out and not backing down on it, proving it. Every time he says proving that he has respect for him. Now, if the person doesn't have respect for his client, looks down upon him and thinks he's a schmuck or something, then I'm sure that shows, and the guy didn't come back again. So I'm talking about successful therapy. In a way, if you take this perspective, that behind it all is shame, and that the first and foremost, you must show respect. You must have respect for this person, and certainly show it, then you're almost home before you start. What you do after that maybe won't make as much difference. But if you don't have that, I don't see how you could succeed with any method. Okay, now turning to the second idea, top of the Freudian idea. I think I was ranting and raving about how wonderful an idea it was and what a revolution it was. Indeed, it was the first revolution from the old notion of bad flesh or bad juice. In this context of type of, say, of tactical differences, of different things to protect from, and different ways of acting, so too do the defenses differ. As you will see when we get into it, that each source of threat requires a different kind of defense, a different kind of protective maneuver. It doesn't do any good to hold up an aluminum reflector that's tissue thin when somebody's shooting at you with a shotgun. But it might be a spiffy defense against beaming in electronic signals that just bounce off your reflector harmlessly. So it is then with defenses. The defenses now become madness specific or type specific rather than being applied indiscriminately to all individuals. Remember how Freud had the defenses. He had them stacked in levels, or they were called lines of defense. You have all memorized the lines of defense, haven't you? They were tied in a rather loose way to the psychosexual stages of development. Oral, anal, urethral, and so on. And then the denial, of course, each repression, and I'm not putting them in their proper order because it depends on which school of psychoanalysis you went to. And the schools have broken up over which comes first, and which is oral and which is anal and so on and so forth. Incorporation, introduction. You know, defense mechanisms, they were called. They were little machines, little tapes, and stacked them this way so that first you deny, then you repress, then you undo, and so on and so forth, in this very, very specific order, depending on which school you're at, Chicago or New York or Los Angeles.
And what stage you're in? Is that
part? Well, these were thought to, let's see, the incorporation was thought to be an oral caper. You can see the analogy. But it's unimportant because what happens to defense theory now is that these things like your suppression, repression, introjection, projection, undoing, reaction formation, and so on and so forth, now are taken off this hierarchy and put over into stashed over into the types, so that now each type has his own defenses that are peculiarly suited to his maneuvers. And instead of each person going through stages of madness, see, the way the Freudians would explain madness was that they would say uh, introjection is more mad than projection. And undoing is less mad than repression. Think like that. There was a hierarchy of how far you flipped out. Now this says, no, they're equal in degree. Let's say a person is no more mad to do undoing than to do suppression or introjection or projection. They don't have anything to do with degrees of madness. You can, this way, you can say that there are degrees of take undoing. One can engage in a bit of undoing with a mildly mad ritual, and the next guy can have an incredibly mad ritual which is still undoing. So let's say the type theory salvages the idea of defense. It takes the idea of self-protection, but it leaves the idea behind that it's hierarchical and linear, that everybody does all of those things. And that's the Freudians were having conniptions for decades trying to get them in just the right order to show how a person ends up in the booby hatch completely flipped out by going through these stages. Let's take a break now, because next thing I want to get into is going to take a little longer. I want to get into the idea of the paradox, which I think I'll go into this fifth topic, because it includes the third one. And
curious, I was wondering, the idea of shame is really important to this theory. What might be said as the difference in the theory between the idea of shame and the idea of guilt? Is there some critical difference between the two? Definition.
Well, I wouldn't. They're completely different ideas. I don't see any similarity between them. A person feels guilty for some dirty deed. A person feels ashamed of themselves because they don't measure up to some kind of standard. And one guilt has to do with events. Shame has to do with one's estimate of oneself in some kind of scale.
A standard.
Scale of values, yeah. Oh, yeah, I suppose you have some people that will use them as if they were synonymous, but they aren't at all. You see, guilt is over committing something, some act. Shame is over being something. Being seen in a certain light. Has to do with, you can feel guilty because you knocked off you wasted a few chicks. But on the other hand, you may be feel proud of yourself, for the way you did it. That is, you say you did it skillfully, so that you don't feel ashamed of yourself, your capability, your skills, but you feel guilty for having done this bad thing. So in a sense, shame has to do with ability, a guilt with the perpetration of evil deeds. Completely different feel.
Shame has more to do with style.
Yeah. Okay. The fifth idea, which really contains the third one, and therefore probably should be number three, is Haley's Revolution, Bates and Haley. And I note in passing that it took somebody outside the field to change the course of the field, an anthropologist and a communications analyst, Gregory Bateson and Jay Haley, to come up with this idea that tactics are relationship defining. And that they always occur in a very special, a situation of special structure, which I want to review, read into the computer. They call it the double bind situation. A situation is, a social context. And remember that the tactical postulate is that symptoms or tactics always occur in a social setting. It's impossible to have one occur in a non-social setting. You can't burn something in a vacuum. You got to have oxygen to burn something. So it is that in order to act crazy, you got to have somebody there to send the message to. Hey, I'm acting goofy. If there ain't nobody there, then you can't act goofy. You can't send a message if there's no receiver. Well, we'll never know. There's no way to settle that one, you know. So that's settled by postulate. Just assume it. Take it for granted. It's like, remember the old problem of if a tree falls in a forest and nobody hears it, was there a sound? Well, what you mean by sound and hearing and that sort of thing. It's a matter of definition. So it is now with the social postulate. But this social setting is said to be a double binding one, and it's got three features, all of which are very, very important features in the structure of the social context. You could call this the double bind context, the DBC, the double bind situation. The first of these is that there is a meta-complementary complementary relation. An intense durable chronic metacomplementary relationship. What do I mean by metacomplementary? Let's review that for a minute. Bateson in 1950 said that there were three kinds of relationships, three kinds of behaviors, and three kinds of messages, that all behavior is communicational. All behavior is in relationship to somebody else. So all behavior is social. These three kinds of behaviors and therefore messages and therefore relationships. So we have messages, behavior, and relationships all lumped together. Well, same thing. And Bateson says, now, there is really no choice in this. You cannot not, in this social context, in any social context, you cannot not send relationship messages. You cannot not do it. If you turn your head, you get in an elevator and you turn your head like that, away from the person standing beside you, what message are you sending? Don't say anything to me, and I'm not going to say anything to you. That's the message. That's what you're saying. You cannot not communicate in a social context. Everything you do is a message. You cannot not behave. You cannot not relate. You cannot not send a message. It's all the same thing. These are equal, which was quite a breakthrough in communication theory. So now these three kinds of messages, behaviors, and relationship. One was called a complementary relation, or complementary message, or complementary behavior. And this, Haley said, was behavior, the exchange of the same kind of behavior. That is, the exchange of different kinds of behavior, reciprocal behavior, so that if I teach, you're supposed to do whatever, respond to that by learning. If I'm a physician and I give you a prescription to take some certain kind of chemical, then you're supposed to respond to that by going to the drugstore and getting those chemicals and ingesting them. That's called complementary relation. That's a complementary relationship, message, and behavior on both our parts. I tell a dirty joke, you laugh and say, "Aren't you funny, Mr. Murgatroyd?" If, on the other hand, you don't laugh very much or just chuckle, "Ho, ho, ho," wait till I tell you the one about, and then you tell me a dirty joke and try to top me and try to get me to laugh, you are behaving in what is called a symmetrical way and trying, so the theory goes, to be one up on me. You're trying to top me. Now, I'm one up on you. Wait. You'll see. I'm one up on you when I prescribe a drug to you and you take it. Or I tell you something, like right now, I'm saying, that's the guy that's behaving in a symmetrical way is trying to get one up on the other. You're supposed to say, you're not supposed to say, uh-uh. You say, oh, well, if you say so, that means it's got to be true. So then you would be behaving in a complimentary way. But when you shake your head and say, uh-uh, you're behaving in a symmetrical way in response to my complimentary maneuver. See, I'm trying to ram this down your throats. Actually, I did it just to see if you would illustrate the principle for me. In other words, I was behaving in a half a complimentary way. That's okay. getting back to the symmetrical, Bateson and Haley redefine this as exchanging the same kind of behavior instead of exchanging different kinds of behavior. So I tell a dirty joke, you tell one back. I instruct you, I tell you that X is ABC, you tell me, and Y is PQR. I give you information, and instead of responding by saying, thank you, this is wonderful, you say, you give me some information. Okay, that is symmetrical behavior, exchanging the same kinds of behavior. Now, is the person who is behaving symmetrically trying to get even or up? Up. Think of tennis. I hit the ball into your court, and I hit it at as big, as wide an angle as I can, and put as much spin on it as I can, so that it'll hit near the edge and jump out of your reach. I'm trying to get it past you. You get over there and you hit it down the line, trying to get it past me. You're trying to get one up on me, and I'm trying to get one up on you. But if as long as we both keep getting the ball back to the other, our behavior is symmetrical, isn't it? We're exchanging the same kind of behavior. But what I want to point out is that we're exchanging one-up behavior.
So you don't stay in symmetrical very long.
Well, that depends on how equal you are. In fact, you know, we might sit here all night telling dirty jokes to each other. If you've got your biggest repertoire as I have. One goes one up as soon as your opponent fails to return the volley. He's now one down and you're one up. Literally, you get a point. Okay? All exchanges are one up. Except the meta-complementary maneuver, which is one down. Now, what does that mean? Let's go back to tennis. Let's say I'm a lot better than you are. And I want you to enjoy yourself and not get discouraged. So I put the ball over in the middle of the court so that you can get at it. And I don't hit it very hard so that you don't have to run very fast. So you get over there and you hit it back to me. Okay, I return the ball and I get it in the middle of the court again. What am I doing? And this is a very, very important word in this theory. I'm permitting you to act as if you're my equal. I'm permitting you to act as if you are not one down. When, in point of fact, you're one down. Because I'm so good with the forehand cross topspin line shot, there's no way you're ever going to get to it. Actually, I'm terrible at it, but I want to make a point here. I want to get one up on you. So the meta is, so to speak, a complementary. It's a comment on the maneuver itself. I am putting by maneuvering you in, by permitting you to behave in a symmetrical way, I'm putting myself one down. I'm one up in the sense that I'm permitting you to be one up. I'm still one up, but now at a different level. And this is where it gets complicated. And this becomes very, very important in psychotherapy because the opening shot in any healer's repertoire is a meta-complementary response to the patient's symmetrical response. And as you permit your patient to tell you how to cure him. When you're going, if you're going the way of Milton Erickson, yeah.
Is meta short for the word metaphor?
No, meta is its own. It's a Greek prefix, and its translation is the English word about. So it's something about something. Meta. It's the same word as in metaphor. But for is Greek for our word bear, to bear about.
Mm-hmm.
No, he didn't use them interchangeably. Metaphor and metacomplementary? No. Metaphor is a story in Haley's book. Oh, yeah, the metaphor is very important. Tactic. That the therapist will use, he'll use a metaphor. When the patient asks for a directive, the therapist will counter with a metaphor. I once knew a guy that did something. He tells a big, long, shaggy dog story. When he's asked for a prescription, he gets a metaphor. But that's quite different from the meta-complementary. Now, where was I? Oh, okay. So this context now. This is the context for madness. This is the context in which tactics spring up. That. Instead of there being an exchange of different behaviors or an exchange of the same sorts of behaviors, there's a metacomplementary response to a symmetrical message. And that is what's going on. And this, I mean, again, is an intense relationship. It makes a lot of difference to both participants. To all participants, which results in none of them getting to walk away. For instance, it's the relationship between spouses or between offspring and parents, or both. And so everybody's in there for keeps, and nobody can walk away. It's already happened that the person who is one up is one up by putting themselves one down, and which makes the relationships terribly complicated and undecipherable. In that situation where this kind of exchange is going on, a paradoxical injunctive is said to have been a directive, is said to have been given. In this case, the unlabeled patient, that is to say, the person who is occupying the metacomplementary position, orders the labeled patient, that's the person who is one up, one down. That is, he's one down by being permitted to be one up.
Okay, that's the unlabeled patient or the scapegoat. Okay, the unlabeled patient orders the labeled patient to do something, but he is to do it. But he is told some way to do it spontaneously, and not out of obedience. He is to do it on his own and for his own reasons, not because he was told to do it. If he does it because he was told to do it, then that won't do. He must do it spontaneously. That is a paradoxical command. That is to say,